She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everyone. I am Gina Murphy Darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World. We are disruptors for good. We are game changers, doing the good thing, the right thing, not just for ourselves, but for all beings who call the earth home. Thanks so much for joining us and for being a part of our world. Also, a big thanks to one of our valued partners, Habitat for Humanity Tucson, for their support of our mission and vision and for all that they do every day to make our community stronger and healthier for all of its citizens. They bring people together to build homes, communities, and hope, and in doing so, create a more compassionate and just world. And indeed, they do. Habitat, thanks for all you do. And I just want to press pause here for a minute and reflect. It's a very personal reflection, but as I was working on this show yesterday, I just stopped to think about my journey in the past 10 years as Mrs. Green and the incredible people I've gotten to meet, the programs that I've gotten to read about, the interviews that I've gotten to do about people whose lives are dedicated to making this planet healthier, safer, and socially just for all of us. And I reflected a lot yesterday because we're going to interview a man who has done a lot of work for people that are really in need. He's made it a life commitment, and he's having incredible success. He's a great leader. So let's get ready for another informative and important show for this hour. We're going international, and that alone excites me. Please join me in welcoming John Armstrong, National Director for Habitat for Humanity, Bangladesh. Yes, Bangladesh. We are speaking with John from Bangladesh. Since 1999, almost 20 years, Habitat for Humanity, Bangladesh has been working with low-income families to build strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat's Bangladesh programs include decent, affordable housing, clean water, something we never have to think about here at this point, and sanitation, training in appropriate construction technology, as well as disaster response and mitigation. So many, many things on the plate of Habitat for Humanity Bangladesh. John, you can tell I'm excited. Thanks so much for being with us. And I'm very eager to learn about more of the incredible work that you do.
It's good to be here.
So let's start with, I talked to you a little bit before we got on the air about just asking you to kind of give us an overview of what Bangladesh looks like. And I mean, its people, the poverty, the strengths. It is among the most densely populated countries in the world. And it's more than, what I read was more than 1,200 people per square kilometer. I mean, it's like hard for us to imagine. So talk to us about Bangladesh, the country, and its people.
One of the things that I like to do is put the whole population thing into perspective. I heard the former U.S. ambassador to Bangladesh do it in a very unique way, and I've actually used the same method with my family. If you compare Dhaka, for example, the capital of Bangladesh, to Tucson, Dhaka is about half the size of Tucson, with 34 times the population.
Oh my! Like, you are kidding. It is hard to even imagine that. Like, it really is hard to, for even to get my head around it. 34 times in the same area. Okay.
If you take Bangladesh to Arizona, Arizona is about twice the size of Bangladesh. But there's 23 times the population in Bangladesh.
I mean,
nearly half of the population of the entire United States of America.
Huge. I mean, really huge. That's massive. And it does put it in perspective. It does paint a picture. And what's the, like, what is the breakdown? And I found some really good information. Thank God for Google. That is my, like, my lifeline to good content and good shows. But there's a a significant amount of low income. And to me, low income in the United States means one thing, and low income in Bangladesh presumably means quite something else. So what is the breakdown between, I mean, is there a vast, vast difference between the very rich and the very poor? And what are we talking about in terms of numbers? And is there an emerging middle class, or is there a middle class at all?
There would be a considered a middle class. But still, you've got 31.5%, I believe, of the population living below the poverty line, which is $2 a day. I was just looking at some of the statistics on the garment industry is huge here. And I was just looking at some of the statistics because Bangladesh has the lowest hourly wage in the world for garment workers, which is about 21 cents an hour.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Okay. And John,
ready-made garments are huge here.
So one of my passions and that of the Mrs. Green's World team, we've done series on the filthy fashion industry. And I'm bold enough to say when I do public speaking, make sure that the T-shirt you have on is not made with the blood of slaves on its hands. And for someone getting 21 cents an hour, I'm going to assume, and one should never assume, in deplorable working conditions, that it's a disgrace. And I was wondering that. I didn't easily find what the main industry is, but I was not surprised at all with your answer. So people are working for 21 cents an hour and making clothes that we get to have cheap. And there's, yes, you know, to me, there's a connection between that, that we work hard in Mrs. Green's World to raise that consciousness about, you know, they say, know your farmer, know who made your T-shirt, know who made your clothes, know who made your shoes. So you have that. Okay. And is it worse? Go ahead. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt at all.
What I was looking at was the 3 million workers were in the garment industry, 90% are women. And I don't know if there was big news there or not, but about 5 years ago, there was a major accident here in a garment factory. It was a building that was actually constructed for residential use. It went above standards, and they built two or three additional floors outside of a code. And when they noticed cracks in the building, the banks and the stores that were located on the lower floors closed, but the garment workers were forced to go back to work. The building collapsed, and over 1,000 people died.
And I remember the day. I remember the day. Oh, yes. And we've talked about it on the show. And to make it even worse, if you ask me, the workers complained, and they told the owners of the building.
Yes.
And they really tried to make them aware. They were aware, not make them aware. They knew what they were doing. And it was a bloody tragedy. I mean, it was so awful. And you know, John, in watching just some things, I just watched a movie a couple weeks ago again called The True Cost. It is 90% women. Pretty much globally, women are the ones that are doing the slave labor. And many times they have to bring their children to work in deplorable conditions, exposed to chemicals, and what child wants to be raised on the floor of a slave factory? And then, if that doesn't work, I watched one, and I mean, my daughter and my husband and I were so upset because some women have to leave their children in rural areas and see them once every 3 or 4 months because they have to work, and they can't afford to have their children taken care of with them. And it's really, and I mean, in The True Cost, it talked about, you know, women being imprisoned. They are beaten by the owners. This was in Bangladesh. And it's very, very troublesome. So you have to deal with that on top of everything else.
I would say in the last 5 years since that major tragedy, there have been improvements.
That's really good to know.
The buyers globally have gotten more interested in safer factories.
And that will always
and
help.
And the other thing, Bangladesh is a serious exporter of labor. There are thousands of, and it's more men who leave the country to work. And then maybe their spouses or brothers or sisters or moms who are working in the garment factories, but they've left the country and are working in the Middle East. They're working in Malaysia, Indonesia, to send money back to Bangladesh.
It's. I mean, there's a lot of components to this that are very sad, and then there's the hope that we're going to talk about making a difference. It's like it really gets to me a lot. But Habitat for Humanity Bangladesh, you operate, from my research, nine project locations across the country. And your goal, as with all of the Habitat for Humanities, is to break the cycle of poverty. Housing is a huge issue, but one of the things that interested me is that you don't just do new construction. There are many poorly constructed homes, so you help with that. So tell us about Habitat for Humanity in Bangladesh. Just give us an overview and take as long as you want for not just the need, but some of your solutions.
The need is a little bit difficult to put your finger on.
Yeah.
There's been some research on the urban needs for housing, and mostly in Dhaka City. The rural need has not been examined nearly as much. But I've got something that says by 2025, at least 4.45 million more housing units will be needed. And that's just in the capital.
Get your head around that number. I mean, 4.5 million more homes will be needed.
Right.
In the blink of an eye. Okay.
And the slum dwellers, there's 4,000 slums in Bangladesh. And they're unwanted and yet needed. It's the housekeepers and the cooks and the drivers and the rickshaw pullers, much needed service providers that live in slums. So they're needed, they're required, but their living conditions are not good. We've begun to try to include much more safety training in our work with them. How to get out of the slum in a fire, how to fight a fire. Little things like stop, drop, and roll. Teaching children how to do that so more of them survive fires. But firefighting as well and escape. There are many, many fires in the slum areas because of the conditions where they must cook and then to keep warm during the cold months, which are very, very short here, but still, it's an issue.
Yeah, when it's cold, it's cold. So, you know, I'm not even going to ask you the question about how you survive, or unless you want to answer it. But to me, sometimes it's hard being Mrs. Green in my very comfortable middle class life that's committed to preserving the planet. There are days when I just want to run away and get a job at Walgreens as a clerk and not read the news. I mean, seriously, because you take in this massive amount of need and, you know, planet destruction and devastation and slavery and sex slavery, but you stay in the fire, John, and you do it and you lead people to help be a solution when the needs are so great and I'm sure depressing at times.
It is because we can only do what we do is a drop in the bucket. I mean, yes, we are helping families and we're giving them a hand up. But it's a drop in the bucket. We can help such a small percentage of the population here. It's a very difficult place to get appropriate funding because of the MDGs and now the SDGs are a little bit better, Sustainable Development Goals, where Habitat did a lot of advocacy to get housing and conditions in cities included in the SDGs. MDGs, it was very, very minor. So the focus has been for us water and sanitation because that was part of the MDGs. And we started working more with toilets and with water that is part of the home, but the house wasn't a priority.
Go figure.
Now, a lot of our funding.
Go figure. It's like people need
exactly,
that.
Exactly. And I can understand. We get a considerable amount of money from Habitat affiliates in the U.S. But even that, getting them interested in Bangladesh is a challenge. Habitat Tucson is our blessing right now because they're interested. A lot of the affiliates, and I don't blame them a bit, want to give their global fund contributions to countries that they can go visit. They can go see, they can do volunteer work in Ecuador and give their funds there, for example. They can go, they can meet the people, they can see what their money is going towards.
Right.
Bangladesh is a world away. And right now we're closed. We've been closed for a number of years because of the security situation. We don't want to put people in danger. But that eliminates a big portion of what we can do for fundraising. Most of what we have is institutional funding from various governments, from Australia, from Korea, from some UK governments, from a few foundations. But it's very, very challenging for us.
You know, and to hear that Habitat Tucson is a great partner, it doesn't surprise me, and it thrills me. I mean, the work they do here is epic, and the fundraising efforts, there's an incredible, passionate team. I'm part of a green team for a big automotive dealership here in Tucson called the Chapman Automotive Group, and we do a home build every year. So it's like they're the corporate. That's what I was thinking about last night, John. The differences that there's no similarities except maybe in the mission of what you have to deal with. And I'm proud that Tucson is a help. So when you talk about new construction, are you doing any of that now? Because I know the homes, quote unquote, homes that you build are quite different from what new construction is in the United States and especially in Tucson.
Yes, actually, when I've gone over that with even my father, he says, well, you're building houses. How big are these houses? And I said, 10 by 12.
Oh, my gosh.
It's 10 by 12.
It's a room.
It's a room, yes, with a veranda. But it's a core house, and they're built so that they can be added onto, and a lot of people close in the veranda and make another room. And actually, when I was in Tucson last fall, I was giving a comparison because I was touring some of the houses that they were building in Tucson, and I walked into one of the bedrooms and I turned to the man who was giving me the tour, and I said, "Yeah, this is about the size of our house."
Oh my gosh.
The bedroom.
Yes, and I'm sure the people who get that one room that's safe and closed in and, you know, impervious to the water and the cold air are grateful for one room. And I can't imagine how many people might be sleeping in it at any given time. It's beyond my comprehension.
Yeah, I mean, families of five or six are living in that room. That's one of the unique things about the culture here, but it makes you throws you off a little bit coming from the U.S. When you're invited into someone's house and they say, well, please sit down. And you look around and all there is a bed. And you're like,
okay.
Can I sit on your bed?
Can I sit?
That's what they're comfortable with. But yeah, please sit down. Okay.
Please.
I mean, I've even been, to be honest with you, I went into a slum one time and I was invited into this room that they had kind of put a makeshift room. And it was designed for a couple that were getting married. So the only piece of furniture was this big bed all decorated with flowers. And they're telling me, hey, sit down. And I'm like, here? You want me to sit
I'm
here?
I'm not sitting on the marriage bed. Please don't make me.
Well,
please don't make me.
No, that's where they want me to sit. Please sit down. And I'm like, no, this is all beautiful and all flowers. I'll sit.
It's okay. I'll stand. So very
yeah,
different.
It's very welcoming. At the same time, you're kind of like, I'm not sure.
I know. That would be very, very different for us. So we're going to take a break in a minute, but I always have to ask this question. And as people that have been listening to me and part of my world and who know me, in that little room, that 10 by 12, is there a toilet or no?
No. Okay. In some of the houses, the new houses that we built, when we have the appropriate funding, we do include an attached toilet and a tube well, which gives them basically everything that they need.
Yeah, just
that's
the thought of it.
That's a complete new start.
I mean, honestly, John, when you think about it, there is just no comparison to the wealth in America. When we come back, I would like to talk a little bit more. There's so many more. I have like pages of notes and questions and on, but I'd like to talk about how do you begin to choose people? How do you select them? And then go into some of the programs, because you don't just have the program that you build homes. There's a lot of other, what I call training and support services that are equally as valuable. And talk a little about that. And then, of course, my big question is, how do you begin to respond to disaster relief? Because you have that going on as well. Everybody, please stay here with me. More great information from John Armstrong from Habitat for Humanity, Bangladesh. We'll be right back.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
And welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. We are the disruptors for good in every way that we know how, and thank you for joining us. With us this hour is John Armstrong, National Director for Habitat for Humanity Bangladesh. Since 1999, Habitat for Humanity Bangladesh has been working with low-income families to build strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. John, thank you so much once again for being here to share the story about Habitat Bangladesh. So let's talk about...
Good to be here.
Oh, it's just so amazing to me and that we have a crystal clear connection. I've had, you know, harder connections to understand with people in San Francisco, so I'm thrilled that we're talking across the globe. So that I'm sure you know that here in the United States, there's an application process. Families have to qualify. They have to attend training about home ownership. They have to put in hours of sweat equity in their home, and then they pay a low-interest mortgage. So how does it work in Bangladesh? Vastly different? Are there any similarities? Tell us about how that program works and how do you begin to select given the high level of need?
That is the biggest challenge. And we're finding that not only the biggest challenge from based on the need, but also based on how to make that selection, how to make it appropriately and transparently. In Bangladesh, for the first 10 years of operation, we were doing the same thing. We were doing low-income, low-cost housing loans. About 6 years ago, it was determined that we weren't registered in a way that we could appropriately do loans. So right. Now the houses are done by grants. There is still a sweat equity requirement, so the homeowners still contribute, whether they're actually doing construction or providing water or whatever to the laborers, the day laborers, but they do contribute. Maybe it's not the homeowner themselves. Maybe it's a cousin. Maybe it's a brother, an uncle. Someone has contributed to the construction. The way that we have been working, we have CBOs, which are community-based organizations, or community wash committees that we have established. And they give us the initial list of proposed beneficiaries. And then we go through the application process and find out what their living condition is, how big the family is, what their security situation is like, to make our final selection. One of the things that I said we face challenges in getting that initial list is because people tend to want to compensate those who put them on the list. And we insist that they don't do that.
Wow!
What we give you is free. You're not paying anyone. But power is a big issue. And as soon as you give somebody a little bit of power, they either ask for the money, or it's expected, it's given, and we have to cut that off. We have to do a considerable amount of follow up and monitoring to make sure that we've done the right selection.
Yeah, that's another interesting perspective.
That is a big chunk.
A big chunk.
Go ahead.
I just want to ask, even if, and I wanted to ask this earlier, even if, like, just say there was, you know, a miracle occurred and you got, you know, $3 million to help with the effort, What about the availability of supplies? Is that an issue, or if you had the money, you could do much more?
Oh, yeah, if we had the money, we could do much, much more.
Okay.
But right now we have a new project we're starting with money from the Korean government, where we're going to be looking at alternative building materials. There are issues here. Tin-sided houses are perfectly acceptable, but they're hot. So what can we do, especially in the face of climate change and increased temperatures, what can we do to reduce the interior temperature? Now, there's brick. We do build brick houses, which are cooler. But brick is another problem here, because in a lot of cases, topsoil is being used to make brick. Well, when you've got a very small country with a huge population and you're trying to grow crops to feed all this population and you're scraping topsoil off to make bricks, something's going to happen that's not going. You're not going to have the production.
Right.
You're going to impact food security by making brick. Plus, they pollute the air when you bake them. So we're going to be looking at alternative materials, whether it's a sand concrete block or whether it's going to be compressed earth blocks, which we've done in the past, but we didn't have continued follow-on funding to actually make it sustainable. In other words, we brought in machines to hand press blocks.
Right.
But the machines were never turned over to someone who could then produce the blocks to continue that on, which needed to be done. So we're looking at alternative building materials for this next project. We're going to be looking at things like including a ceiling to keep the heat from the roof up into the attic space, or up into the roof space. We did a project where we tested putting a bamboo sheet in between the tin roof and the rafters, which actually reduced the interior temperature. So these are some of the things we're going to be trying to do in the next 3 years with this project. It's going to be a huge issue. There's 28 million people in Bangladesh that are at risk just along the coastline between now and 2050. Who are going to just lose their livelihoods, their land, everything, because of a rise in sea levels. So temperature is another issue, but also water is a big issue. Water is either saline inundated, or I just visited a community recently where we're doing some work, actually with Habitat money for orphans and vulnerable groups. And the community is what's called Rishipara, and they're considered untouchable Hindu population. So they're discriminated against, they're poor, a lot of things involved with them. But every time I saw one of the tube wells, I would ask, what's the condition of this water? And I hear, well, this is salt water. So we use it for bathing and washing clothes and dishes. And then this one is sweet water. But they'll tell you this one is sweet water, but it's contaminated with arsenic. And I can still recall getting to one, because sweet water that is actually not contaminated with arsenic is 5 kilometers away, and they have to walk and carry it back or carry it on a bicycle. But I was standing at one tube well, and there was a little boy, maybe 2 years old, and his mom was just getting him a drink of water. And I said, tell me about this tube well. And they said, well, this one's sweet, but it's arsenic contaminated. And I said, he's drinking from this well. Well, got to do what you got to do sometimes.
It's just hard to get your head around. And it's so weird, because this morning I do live consciously in every way I can, and I was brushing my teeth, and I turned the water off, and I thought, how many people got up this morning and realized that this is a gift? Just being able to brush the teeth, flush the toilet, take a shower, and being mindful of the billions of people that don't have that luxury. They might have access to some clean water, but not anywhere to the extent that we do. So what about a lot of your work, or what percentage of your work is a better question, is dedicated to home repairs and major or minor renovation? You have new construction, but I also know that you do a lot of work to improve the living conditions that are less than adequate, and by our standards, totally inadequate. How much of the work you do is dedicated to that piece?
More than 50% of our work is dedicated to that piece, because that actually gives us an opportunity to make a donor's money go farther.
Yes.
We can impact more families by doing major and minor renovations than we can by building new houses. The new houses that we build right now are about $2,500 per house.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
No, couple of $100 you can do a minor renovation, $500 you can do a major renovation. You can repair the roof, replace the roof. You're not always leaving them with something that people in our culture might find acceptable, but it's a big improvement over what they had.
Right.
It's much more secure. It's not keeping the rain out, or the floor is now concrete. And there's a lot of research on the difference in susceptibility to disease of children that are on dirt floors compared to cement floors. The amount of disease that is transferred from soil, from dirt, from living on a dirt floor.
Right.
So that's a big improvement. And a lot of times we can use the existing roof, if it's in relatively decent condition, the roof sheets, to improve the walls when we put on a new roof. So there's quite a few things that we can do there. And then we actually increase the resilience of the house to high winds, to cyclone, to storms, by improving the pillars that hold the roof and support the roof. And so it's a considerable portion of our work.
I mean, my head is spinning. And so what would a minor renovation look like? A roof is a major renovation. What are some examples of what you could do with a little bit to help a lot?
Probably a raised plinth, raising the foundation of the house.
Got it.
To get it above flood level, because this is a delta and there's considerable flooding in Bangladesh. Maybe just improving the security, the doors and windows.
Got it.
Might be a minor renovation.
Yeah.
Those kinds of things.
Making it safer.
Yes.
And what about I don't even know how you're going to be able to answer this question, you know, and I'm not trying to be dramatic. You can obviously tell that this impacted me. The deeper I went, the deeper I went. And I was up really late last night reading more. And there's the question of disaster relief. There's flooding, there's landslides. And don't think I didn't notice your reference to climate change. I mean, in my work, marginalized communities are always hit first and hit hardest, and they're being displaced by the hundreds of thousands already. 500 children a day die in Africa from starvation. So the poorest of the poor are being impacted already. And I think by 2050, we don't, you know, I can't even think about that actually, because climate change is real and brutal and accelerating. So when there are disasters, what can you do with Habitat? You're already doing so much. How do you respond to disasters? How do you begin to help?
It's not easy. And it's always a matter of finding the funding, finding it fast enough, and getting the appropriate approvals to get in and actually do some work. We've responded to cyclones in the same area that were hit 2 years in a row by cyclones, and doing transitional shelters, which is actually, the house is made of tin, but it's solid pillars, it's a cement floor, it's a raised plinth. It's a transition for them to move to something even stronger. We also include training in that and mitigating activities that they can do, or mitigating activities that they can conduct either on the house or in the community to reduce the impact of the next storm. We had flooding, considerable flooding this year, but it's been very, very hard for us to respond. The funding actually ended up going to neighboring countries who also had the flooding, because it was regional. And we're still trying to respond, and we're going to be actually working with the rebuilding portion of the emergency. The disaster itself was addressed by agencies going in with food, tarpaulins, that kind of temporary things. We're going to go in and build actual shelters that can then be upgraded.
Right. And there are so many extreme climate events going on around the country. And of course, even here in the United States, I was listening to something on NPR this morning about families in Houston. And I've said this in some of the talks I give. We have the disasters. America, middle America, is very philanthropic, as you know. We give a lot, we help. But honestly, we move on. Like, Puerto Rico is not making the news. Every once in a while, they tell us that two-thirds of Puerto Rico has power. Like, what does that even mean to us? To think of my life without power for months and months is unthinkable. So it's yeah, you have many, many extreme weather. I mean, typhoons, just things that you have to think about. And then the millions of people, the density of the population, even trying to navigate those areas. You know, like Hurricane Sandy shut down everything. All disaster relief because so many trees were in the roads. Well, take that times a million. You have Bangladesh. It's like, oh, it's daunting. So what about, I'd love you to talk more about safe water and the sanitation. How do you help with that? And what kind of programs does Habitat have in place for clean water, which, as you know, is then a ripple effect? Disease is less, kids can get educated. I mean, it's something as simple as clean drinking water can be transformative for families and children and entire communities. So what do you do about that?
Let me just give you an example. We went into a community about 5 years ago, and it was, to me, it was a unique community. Maybe 300 families, all centered around a big pond. And the pond seemed to be the center of life. Everything happened in the pond. That's where they bathed. That's where they brushed their teeth. That's where they washed their dishes and their clothes. That's where the kids played. But it was also where the toilets drained. So we designed a project. We wanted to go in and do total sanitation. We wanted to disconnect every toilet that drained into the pond. Everyone got a new toilet. We built tube wells. And we came up with something that wasn't common, and actually some of my staff said that it wouldn't work when we first tried it, and that was to build a tube well, and you have to put it on someone's land. So you build it on this man's land, and he agrees to share it with 10 of his neighbors, and then we put an enclosure around it. Because I travel all around Bangladesh, and I see people bathing in ponds. Okay, and for most men, that's probably not a big deal. But for a woman to try to bathe in a pond, in a shari, trying to maintain her dignity, and then to even fathom trying to address feminine hygiene, I couldn't imagine it.
I can't either.
So we put these enclosures around the tube wells. And initially, I was told, no, that's not going to work, because a man will let his wife go to the pond to bathe, but he's not going to let her go to a neighbor's tube well and bathe. But they do. And it's reduced skin disease. It's reduced diarrheal disease. The whole health situation in the entire community has changed.
So how much now, does something like that cost? Like, to do one, how much does it cost to install one of those?
Oh, a tube well, maybe $200.
Okay.
It's not bad at all. And the enclosure was just CI sheets. It was just tin sheets. But it gave enough privacy. I'm sure when completely undressed, that's the modesty level here is too high. But gave them an opportunity to address some of the issues that they can in a pond. And we've done the same thing. We've done built bathhouses now in some of the slum communities that we go into. I mean, obviously we would go in and we would either build community toilets or we would renovate community toilets. You know, where you've got a community toilet with maybe 14 stalls, 7 for men and 7 for women, used by 1,500, 2,000 people. Huge queues every morning for people to use the toilet. So we've renovated those, but then we've also built these bathhouses. It was interesting, the very first slum that we went into, we built two bathhouses for women. And we had established a committee, the wash committee, and they were to manage all of the things, the improvements that we made. We installed a waste management system, and they actually, we delivered to them the mechanism for them to collect a little bit from each family so that the trash would be collected and removed from the community. But I went back about 6 months after we did this, and they were showing me around, and And they showed me the two bathhouses, and they said, now, this one's for men, this one's for women. And I said, whoa. we built these for you ladies. Why are the men using? Oh, no. We agreed. And we can still use one if they're not in it, but the men can use it. Oh, okay. Well, as long as you agreed, I'm good.
Okay, hold that thought. I mean, just my mind is officially boggled. Everybody stay here with me. 30-second break. More from John Armstrong, Habitat Bangladesh. We'll be right back.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I am Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. We are the disruptors for good. We are game changers, doing the good thing, the right thing, not just for ourselves, but for all beings who call the earth home. And clearly, in listening to this show and spending time with John and learning about it, there are certainly a lot of good things and right things that we can consider doing for Habitat Humanity Bangladesh, and I hope people are inspired to do that. Thank you, our listeners, for being a part of our world. Joining us for this hour is John Armstrong, National Director for Habitat for Humanity Bangladesh. Since 1999, almost 20 years, Habitat for Humanity Bangladesh has been working with low-income families, and I want to put an emphasis on low-income, 21 cents an hour kind of families, to build strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. John is sharing with us a myriad of programs they offer in one of the most densely populated countries in the world. Hard to even get your head around that. John, thank you so much for sharing what you're sharing. And, you know, instead of depressing me, it's inspiring me to figure out how to do more and give more and be a part of this change. So thank you for all you're doing and for sharing this. So we were talking about clean water, which, again, nobody in this country has to ever think about, like not ever. Even if you're homeless, you can go into any of our many fast food restaurants. We have public libraries. I mean, it's never the same here. There is extreme poverty, but it's not like that. It's apples and oranges, if you ask me. Not that I want anyone to live in poverty or think it's easy, but it's just, it's worlds apart. Would you not agree with that assessment?
Yes. And actually, I was going to say something before when you were talking about brushing your teeth.
Yeah.
Because when I go back to the U.S., my family lives in rural New York, just south of Albany, New York, up in the Catskill Mountains. And it actually crosses my mind when I turn on the tap and I can put my toothbrush under the tap. Because I can't do that here. Because I end up with 2 days of diarrhea. I use bottled water to brush my teeth. And just that little simple thing where you can actually put it under the faucet is amazing. It kind of goes, ooh, I like this. Oh, kind of cool.
And, you know, I want to reflect back, too, think when you were talking about Ecuador. That's where my heart lives a lot of the times. I just took another trip there. And poverty there, it's not the same. I mean, unless you live in Quito, but there's so much country. And the people that I spent a lot of time with deep in the jungle who do not have fresh water, they don't have access to clean water, they have so much access to the things they need because they can get water from the rivers and boil it, and they know that, and they can take they can swim in the rivers because they're not polluted. This is in, you know, the Achuar people where I went to in Ecuador, and there's millions of acres that have not been destroyed by oil companies yet. So Ecuador is different, in my opinion. I'm so impressed with their culture and their commitment to their children. And, you know, they do have enclosures in some of the villages for women and men for the bathroom, where they have, you know, dug holes and stuff like that. But it's not the same as what you're describing in anything that I saw. And I went deep into the jungle. But they, you know, they catch fish, they kill birds, they have monkeys. There's other animals that they, you know, kill and eat and use all body parts for their survival. So it's just, in Bangladesh, when you have the density, it's just not the same. What about, how much are you able to do? I call it, you know, if you give a man a fish, he has food for a day, but you teach him how to fish. And when I was reading about your training, the technical still, you know, the construction technology training you provide to people in rural areas who don't even have those basic skills, you know, what does that look like? How much are you able to do with all of the needs that you have? It's like, it's a great model, but how do you do it, John?
I mean, there's been different levels of the technical assistance and training that we've been able to do. The technical assistance that goes with just our going into a community and starting to build houses or toilets, it's basically how you do this, how you make it strong, how do you make it sure that it's going to be sustainable, it's not going to fall down in a year. We've also gone to trying to provide actual construction skills training to unemployed youth, as well as women. We did the unemployed youth, and it's a lot of men getting into masonry or carpentry or electrical installation of wiring. And then we've also done some home textile work for women so that they can establish their own businesses. That has been very, very successful. The young people that come out of that training are able to either start their own business or at least go to work for someone as a certified technician.
And that changes the cycle of poverty. I mean, that really does.
Yes, it does. It gives them an opportunity to start something new and really turn their life around. And the women, because school uniforms are huge here. And it's like every child has to have a school uniform. Well, you give a woman some training and you give her a sewing machine, even if it's got a pedal, she can crank out school uniforms and supplement her family income or support her family. We work with a lot of women-headed households. One comes to mind, we built this woman a house, her and her two daughters. She had been alone for about 15 years. I think her husband had left. And it was interesting to hear her say, because, you know, families worldwide are pretty much the same. You know, you can get along with your brother or your sister for a while, but when you live together every now and then. And she said one of the biggest benefits, or one of the things she really appreciated about having her own secure house now, was that her sister couldn't threaten to throw her out if they had a disagreement.
Oh my gosh, listen to that. I mean, but that's real. That's a thing. That is a real thing. Oh my gosh. So it's just the simple things for a probably 10 by 12 room. It's unreal.
Yeah.
I'm very.
But it's a dry, secure place for her kids to study.
Yes, yes.
She was putting both her children through school to make sure that they had more than she had. And she was working, I think, as a domestic worker, working in someone else's house to clean and cook. But she had a place to live, a secure home that she didn't have to worry about repairing every other day.
Just the things. I'm going to live this day so filled with gratitude for every single thing I do, including, you know, reaching for the 10 pens that are by the side of my desk and everything. I mean, it puts me in a place of extreme gratitude and then passion for what can we do to make a difference. I'm very curious about philanthropy within the country. I mean, in a lot of countries, let's be honest, if there's a strict caste system, there are the haves and the have-nots, and there's a philosophy among some cultures that I was born into this caste system and you were born into that one, and that's the way it goes. What is it, in terms of the very rich, is there a general sense for, are they trying to give back? Is there a portion of them that care deeply? What's the philanthropy landscape look like in Bangladesh?
Yeah, it's just a portion, and I would say probably a small portion. We just had some very
generous donors who are Bangladeshi Americans that gave us a considerable amount of money here to do a project, basically in memory of their parents. But actually, local contributions, there's not that much. We had one recent one, and it's actually a very touching story, but I don't know if we want to go there. But there was a young woman in the attack that happened about almost 2 years ago. She was an Emory student, Bangladeshi American, and her mother has companies here. And she was actually a volunteer with Habitat Bangladesh when she was in high school. And she was killed in the terrorist attack. And her mother wanted to then try to realize some of her dreams. And she came to us with some funding for, we have now a fellowship in our office for youth volunteers. And she built a number of houses. We had a huge youth build celebration last fall with 120 young people and the U.S. ambassador. It was really a big day. It was quite a day. That philanthropy was there, but on a large scale, no, it's not. It's not big.
And thank you for sharing that story. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
There are companies that want to give us funding, but then there's also getting the appropriate permission from the government to receive it. We're registered to receive funding from overseas. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So the government has to give permission for a company to give you money within Bangladesh? That's a twist.
Yes.
Wow.
They do.
Okay.
I wish, you know, Habitat India, they actually have benefited from a government law that it requires every company to give money, a certain amount of their profits to
that's
non-profit.
A good thing. That's a good thing.
Yes, I wish that would happen here.
Yes, yes. That's really an amazing thing. What thought leadership there. What about Rotary International? I'm a member of Rotary, and I'm not up. We've done amazing things, you know, to stop polio and to get water to areas that don't have access to it. It's one of the major initiatives. Does Rotary International have a presence at all in Bangladesh? I admit that I do not know that.
Yes, they do. And we had an exercise about a year ago. It ended up to be a little disappointing, and I won't say that goes anywhere generally against Rotary, but we worked for a long time with one of the affiliates, Habitat affiliates in Wisconsin, who wanted to get Rotary involved in funding a project. And we worked on it for a long time, and Rotary International was on board, but when it came down to some of the details, the local Rotary organization kind of backed off on it, and it got real complicated, and we weren't able to do it.
That's really unfortunate. It is.
They are here. And, yeah.
But that's good for me to know.
Yeah, it just got very, very complicated.
Yeah, that's really...
I mean, they wanted us to get quotations for all of the materials we were going to buy before they'd even sign an agreement to give us the money. And
wow.
It was like, well, that's all going to change, and it didn't work out.
It's kind of counterintuitive to giving, and it's not like they were giving to Joe's Bar and Grill. It was Habitat for Humanity Bangladesh, so there might be another opportunity there just through this conversation, and I'm not going to make promises I can't keep, but we have an extremely philanthropic Rotary Club, and we do great things globally and locally, so I'm glad I asked the question.
When I went to their meeting, they were very philanthropic. I mean, the members.
Yes.
After
yes.
the meeting, several of them, I have some land here that I'm not using. Can I donate that to Habitat? And various things that they wanted to do. They have a program here where they distribute reusable sanitary pads, which come in a package with undergarments and pads. And they wanted to get involved with our sanitation and wash projects from that angle, distribute these kits along with the training that you do.
Just that.
So they were very comfortable.
Yeah, think about that too. Just not having access to feminine hygiene products. Another thing I never had to give a thought to in my whole entire life, and I am not rich. I wasn't born rich. We were working middle class people that had to watch every penny, but I never had to give that a thought. It's just that gratitude place again. What about? Go ahead.
I'm very proud of the project that we've done with. We do hygiene training on a general level, but we've started doing menstrual hygiene in high schools, where we go in and we build girls' toilets. In some cases, we renovate the boys' toilet, but we build the girls' toilet, and it's specifically built so that they can address their needs. Because girls here end up hitting puberty and missing a week of school every month, and then they get behind and they drop out.
Right.
So keeping them in school. But we also do training. We do an orientation for boys, telling them kind of what menstruation is, bringing it out of the dark ages and saying it's perfectly natural and this is what happened, and giving the girls an actual training. And we establish a committee, a hygiene committee, and I actually asked some of the girls, I said, what was the most important thing that you learned in this training? And they said, puberty. We know what happens in puberty. I mean, you could never do sex education training here, but hygiene and health and a little bit of biology, you can do. And they really appreciate it.
It's a start. It's a start.
Yes.
Okay, we don't have a lot of time left, but I would like to ask you before we go, and I mean, everybody can always find ways to find you by coming to Mrs. Green's World website. We put all the links to, there is a habitatbangladesh.org website that I went to read about a lot of this. So we will tell people how to connect with you. There's a donate button that makes it very easy to donate. So that's easy. And before we end, I want to talk about the upcoming shows. Our Down to Earth next week is Ted Behrens, Director of Renewable Energy. And it's about storing solar. And that is a huge challenge, the battery storage challenge. So Ted will be joining us from Tucson Electric Power. And we have another, what I'm going to be bracing myself for, show on the 27th with Zama Neff, Director of Children's Rights Division of the Human Rights Watch, Our Children Protecting Their Rights and Their Lives. It's going to be a rough show for me, but I am up to the challenge, and hopefully it will inspire all of us to get more active in answering some of the needs of the global challenges we face. So, John, in the last couple of minutes, we only have a couple. What about volunteers? You know, the Habitat for Humanity Tucson could not exist, nor have it could exist, but not have nearly the impact without the help of thousands of volunteers that do home build days and companies that give their employees the day off. And we do so much in terms of helping with volunteers. What do you have over there? Who can volunteer?
The biggest portion of our volunteer program now is from corporations who want to go out and do a staff build, which I find is a big team builder for my staff. But MetLife does a lot of work. We just got Heidelberg Cement involved. They pay to build the houses, and then their staff go out and work on the house. Volunteers in the U.S., you know, they give a donation along with their volunteer time. That doesn't happen here. Youth volunteers, they're very interested, but they're not able to be able to give a donation along with their volunteer time. So it's not as big as it was, you would say, as it is in the United States. It's not a most critical part of our program. It's something that we certainly welcome, and we try to promote. And I wish that our global volunteer program was open. This year's an election year, so it's certainly not going to happen this year, but I have hopes that it will happen sometime in the future.
And I'll hold that hope for you. And for people that are listening, I always say this, if you are touched by this show, which anybody that's a part of Mrs. Green's World, I can pretty much guarantee will be touched deeply by the need that you, the picture of need that you painted for us, the things that we have that we take for granted. Just a $5 donation a month can make a difference for a program like yours. Think of what can be done for $5 in Bangladesh or $10. And it's like giving up a Starbucks or your favorite latte or something for $5. And that's what I encourage people to do, because big donations are great. So are lots of little small ones. It just helps so much to make the mission happen and execute it. So, and I'll be back in touch, John. This was a wonderful show for me to do, and I'm a big fan of Habitat for Humanity Tucson and the work they do. So I'm glad that we made it work, and thank you for spending this hour with us. It was amazing.
Well, thank you for the time. Thank you for listening.
Make it a great green week, everybody. Step up.